So thank you for the introduction. So and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here. So I'm very excited to tell you about some work I've been doing with Nima and Song He and Thomas Lam and Gong Wang, who's one of Song's students. So the first thing that I want to do today is to introduce a novel way of thinking about a class of amplitudes, scattering amplitudes, and it's associated with the words positive geometries and conical forms. So loosely speaking, a positive geometry is a closed geometry with boundaries of all co-dimensions. So for example, a polytope would be an example of a positive geometry. But in general, you can also have curved boundaries. And the crucial point about positive geometries is that every positive geometry has a unique differential form called its conical form, or sometimes also called the D-log form. So the conical form is a complex form defined by three properties. So first, it must have logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of the geometry. And second, that its geometry, singularities are recursive, so at every boundary, the residue at that boundary is a canonical form on that boundary. And finally, the canonical form has unit leading singularities. So these properties, along with some topological assumptions, ensure that the canonical form is unique for each geometry. Let me just quickly go over some properties of canonical forms, and then I'll say the relevance for physics and why we care about these things. So for example, if we subdivide a positive geometry, it has the property that the canonical form of the full geometry is the sum of the canonical forms for all for the triangulating pieces. And this, for example, is actually how BCFW recursion works in planar integrals for a super YAML. So I'll come back to that a little later. So this might seem like an obvious geometric statement, but it's actually fairly non-trivial, and it requires a careful derivation, which we give in our paper. And the second fact about canonical forms, which is probably a little less familiar, is called the push-forward property. And the idea is that if you have a diffeomorphism from one geometry to another, then that pushes the canonical form of one to the other. And it turns out that this actually provides an explanation for some of the scattering equation formulas. So I'll describe that as well. And the main reason that we care about positive geometries is that sometimes positive geometries appear in physics, in which case the canonical form is a physical quantity, such as an amplitude. The primary example of positive geometry that appears in physics is the amplituhedron, which you might have heard about. So this talk is not really about the amplituhedron, but I just want to point out that from our point of view, the amplituhedron is a geometry for every k, n, and l. So k is the, so if you have n particle nk MHV amplitude in planar integrals for super YAMLs, the canonical form at tree level is the tree amplitude, and at loop level, it's the integrand. So if you work with the amplitude, you might have worked with the amplitude before, but you may not have heard it described as a positive geometry. So one of the funny facts in this business is that the amplitude is thought of as a differential form on the underlying geometry. And this is an important point that I'll come back to many times. One of the things I will do is explain the sense in which the amplitude should be thought of as, or can be thought of as a differential form. And I want to argue that that's, in some sense, a deeper way of thinking about the amplitude. So this idea of constructing positive geometries and interpreting its canonical form as some amplitude has appeared multiple times. So today I'll tell you about one new example where the positive geometry is basically it's a classical polytope called the associahedron, discovered by mathematicians in the 60s. And its canonical form, I claim, is a scattering amplitude. So you can derive the scattering amplitude. In this case, it's the tree level amplitude of planar bi-adjoint theory at tree level. So in this case, you can derive the biadjoint amplitude as the geometric invariant of the associahedron. And as I will explain, the associahedron knows a lot about the physical properties of the theory. So it knows everything, for instance, about the Unschel amplitudes, tree amplitudes, and properties of the amplitudes like locality, unitarity, and various soft limits can all emerge naturally from the geometric point of view. And also we find some surprising connections to scattering equations and color kinematics. So I will describe those as well. So let me remind you what the associahedron is. So it's a polytope. There's one in every dimension. And so there are many clever ways of saying what the associahedron is. So here I'll describe one that is closest to physics. So if you imagine having a regular polygon with n edges, so here I've drawn a pentagon at the top. And then what you do is you draw all the partial triangulations of the polygon. So partial triangulation means that you have non-intersecting diagonals. So here on the second row, I drew the partial triangulations with one diagonal. And then the next row, the partial triangulations with two diagonals. And then you just keep going until you can't draw any more diagonals. And finally, we connect two partial triangulations if they're related by addition of one diagonal. Once you have this graph, you can construct the polytope. So the associahedron is a polytope whose boundaries are dual to the partial triangulations. So every codimension D boundary is dual to a partial triangulation with D diagonals. So here I'm showing a picture of the associahedron with a pentagon, which also happens to be a pentagon. So the associahedron is on the left side. And you can see that the bulk of the associahedron and the edges and the vertices are all dual to the partial triangulations on the right. And they're connected together based on how they're connected on the diagram on the right. We can also draw the associahedron for the hexagon, which is now three-dimensional. The general dimension is n minus 3. And here I've only labeled the vertices in terms of triangulations of a hexagon. But you should imagine that all the facets and edges can be labeled as well. Now the connection to amplitudes begins with the observation that partial triangulations are dual to cuts on planar cubic diagrams, with each diagonal corresponding to a cut. So in this case, so here I've drawn an octagon with two diagonals corresponding to a double cut of a cubic diagram with eight external legs. So in general, you can think of a codimension D boundary of the associahedron as corresponding to some D cut of cubic amplitude. And if you think of the cubic diagrams as Feynman diagrams, then so the boundaries of the associahedron are dual to the singularities of a cubic amplitude. So it seems like the associahedron knows a lot about the structure of planar cubic amplitudes. So it's therefore natural to look for an explicit construction of an associahedron inside kinematic space. So we're going to construct an associahedron in kinematic space. And let me just establish some notation. So we imagine we're scattering in massless particles in an arbitrary number of dimensions. And we define the usual Mandelstam variables, S, I, J. So there are n choose two of these. And you can also define variables with more than two indices. But those are written as a sum over the ones with two indices. Those can be written as a sum over the ones with two indices. And these variables are in general not independent due to kinematic constraints. So there are n constraints coming from momentum conservation. So that reduces the space to a lower dimension. So the dimension will be important for us. And in order to what we're going to do is we're going to cut out the associahedron from the kinematic space. So we'll do that by imposing some linear inequalities. So we require that all the planar propagators be positive. So this is a natural thing to do because we expect the boundaries to correspond to cuts. But this is obviously not the associahedron. The number of inequalities, because the number of inequalities also happens to be dimension of the kinematic space, so it's really giving you some simplex in kinematic space. But the associahedron is actually of a lower dimension. So,
sorry, the definition of the associahedron requires you to pick up an ordering, right?
Yes, right. So,
could you explain what the corresponding object would be for the amplitudes? Would you do this for gravity?
So in this case, since we're studying the bi-joint theory, so there's two orderings in the bi-joint theory.
So maybe you can define the theory for us.
Yes, I mean, I'll come back to the bi-joint theory, but you can define it for any ordering. Because, so if you have an ordering, then you pick all the planar propagators in that ordering, and you set that to be positive. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just wanted you to tell us how the ordering would appear in the amplitudes.
The ordering appears in the construction, so in the first step where you.
So you're going to explain that later.
Yes. So we had a problem that the associahedron is of lower dimension. So in fact, this is a point of confusion for us, but we managed to resolve it. So the key is to restrict to a subspace of the appropriate dimension. And what we do is, this part is slightly tricky. So what we do is the following. So we single out one of the particles, say particle n, and then we set the variable Sij to some constant for all the non-adjacent indices from 1 to n minus 1. So we exclude the index n. And if you do this, you find that, well, first of all, the number of constants is just right so that you cut the space down to the right dimension. So this space has the right dimension for the associahedron.
I'm just curious, why did you, like, based on the stuff that you said so far, maybe I missed it, but why did you know to look for an associahedron?
We didn't. We found the polytope before we realized it was an associahedron.
I see. So you first did this cutting and then realized it has nice properties.
Yeah, well, the cutting comes from it comes from the fact that the amplitude has poles in all those spaces. And then we basically realized that the amplitude was the canonical form of a polytope. And so we worked out the polytope, and then we realized that it was just those.
Is there a physical interpretation of setting these things to constants?
So I think this is the weirdest part of this whole thing. So the physical interpretation, as I'll explain later, has to do with taking a trace. When you set these things to constant, you're actually it's related to taking a trace decomposition in a colored amplitude. So maybe I'll explain that at the end.
The point is, once you do this, you will not get the most general amplitude, right? Or will you?
So this will give you the bi-joint amplitude.
It won't give it to you for all possible incoming momentum.
So we restrict it to be a constant, but it could be any negative constant. So it still gives you, so it's not over-constraining the kinematics.
Oh, I see, sorry. In different momenta configurations, they're different associator.
Right. Yeah, there's different subspaces where. So there's different. There's like a foliation of associator. But once you stop, once you have the geometry and you write down the canonical form, then you can analytically continue everything. And the main claim is that the intersection with the simplex cut out by the propagators, and the non-adjacent constants is an associohedron. And basically, the way to see this is to show that all the boundaries correspond to cuts on planar cubic diagrams in the way that was described earlier. But this is more or less true by construction, since the boundaries are defined by the cuts. The main subtlety is that we need to we still need to argue that if you take cuts corresponding to diagonals that cross, or like non-planar cuts, for instance, you have to show that these cuts are forbidden, and they don't give you a boundary of the polytope. And so, to provide another answer to your previous question, this is part of where the constants come in. If you assume those constants then are negative, then you can show with a little bit of algebra that this is actually kinematically impossible. So the boundaries of our polytope are in one-to-one correspondence with cuts on planar cubic diagrams. And so the polytope is an associohedron. So let me show you some examples. So on the left is it's an actual numerical plot. So you can do this on Mathematica. So you set some numerical values for the constants, and then you you plot the region that you get by imposing all the inequalities. This is a 6-point example. And you find that it has the same shape as the associohedron. So on the right side is what people usually would draw as an associohedron. But on the left side is an actual numerical plot of kinematic space. So actually, let's look at this more carefully. So here I labeled every facet by its corresponding cut. And so one of the goals of this talk is to show the connection between this picture and the corresponding amplitude. So we haven't done any calculations yet, but this picture already actually just tells you a lot about the bijoint amplitude. So for example, if you take two facets that don't intersect, so for example, if you take this one, S23, and S345, over there. So those facets don't intersect, and what they're telling you is that the double cut vanishes. So you can extract that information just from the picture. On the other hand, if you take two facets that do intersect, say, so if you take S23 again, and S234, so they intersect in a line, and that's telling you that the double cut is non-vanishing. You can say the same thing about triple cuts, for example. So a triple cut is non-vanishing precisely if the three facets intersect at a vertex. So this is a way of getting some quantitative information about amplitudes just from the picture. And in higher dimensions, a D cut is non-vanishing precisely if the corresponding codimension D boundary exists. Now remember, so that the associohedron is a positive geometry, and positive geometries have canonical forms. So the next step is to obtain the canonical form of the associohedron and look for its physical interpretation. And if we do that, we find that we get the bijoint amplitude. So let's see how that works. So we first start with a simple observation, which is that the associohedron is what's called a simple polytope. So simple polytope means that every vertex is adjacent to exactly D facets, where D is the dimension of the polytope. So in this case, every vertex is adjacent to three facets. And for a simple polytope, the canonical form is very easy to write down. So the idea is for each vertex, we take the equations that are adjacent to the facets. So those are the F, A, Z. So Z is any vertex. And F, A, Z are the equations for the adjacent facets. And the idea is you take the D log of all the equations. And this expression is anti-symmetric in the facets, so we have to be careful about the ordering of the facets. And the idea is that you order the facets based on how they're oriented around the vertex. In case that's not clear, I'll elaborate that on that a little later. And finally, we sum over the vertices. And you can convince yourself that this expression satisfies the conditions that define a canonical form. So if you apply this to the associahedron, you find that the form is a sum over the vertices. But remember that every vertex corresponds to a triangulation of the N-gon, and or therefore a planar cubic diagram. So that means that the canonical form is a sum over planar cubic diagrams, which is a good sign since we wanted to get an amplitude. And I want to emphasize that the sum over cubic graphs is not something that we put in by hand. It's a geometric output of the associahedron. So let's look at the expression for each vertex. So it's a product of the D-log of the equations for the adjacent facets. But the adjacent facets are just given by cutting the individual propagators on that diagram. And so the expression for each vertex is just the D-log of all the propagators. So here I drew a 6-point cubic diagram corresponding to a vertex of a 6-point associahedron. And the vertex term is just the D-log of the propagators, which almost looks like the expression for that, the Feynman expression for that diagram. And if you add all of these terms together, this almost looks like an amplitude expression. But not quite, since there's a factor in the numerator which looks different for each diagram. But remember that we define a subspace, and what I claim is that if you pull back onto the subspace, the numerator is actually exactly the same for every diagram. And so all the expressions add to give you an amplitude. So I won't prove this entirely, but I'll give you some idea about how it works. So the numerator in each vertex term is anti-symmetric. So you might worry that if you order the propagators in the wrong way in one of the diagrams, you could get a minus sign in one of the diagrams, and that would be bad. But actually, this wouldn't happen. So remember, the propagators are ordered by orientation of the facets. So in the three-dimensional case, so for example, in three dimensions, the way you would order the facets at every vertex is by, say, a right-hand rule in this case. So you can order, for instance, at this vertex, you can order the facets, say, clockwise or counterclockwise. And if you do this, then you find that the numerator is exactly identical for each vertex. So in this case, the boundary structure of the associahedron is actually saving you from sign mistakes. So somehow the association knows that it's supposed to add all of the Feynman diagrams. So the expression for each cubic diagram is literally the amplitude expression times the common factor. So if you add all of them together, you get the bi-adjoint amplitude. And this is the sense in which the amplitude can be thought of as a form. And one important point I want to emphasize is that there's a big kinematic space, and then there's a subspace where the associahedron lives. So if you just add the diagrams in the big space, they don't give you the amplitude, because the numerator is different for each diagram. But they become the same when you pull back to the subspace. So let me give you a concrete example of 4 points. So we use the usual Mandelstam variables as T and U. So in this case, the kinematic space is two-dimensional. So I'm plotting kinematic space in terms of S and T. So remember, there's a big simplex and a subspace. The big simplex in this case is the positive quadrant. And the subspace is the 45-degree line, where U is a negative constant. And the associahedron is the part where you intersect the two. So that's the red part. That's the red line. And the geometry, so this is the one-dimensional association, which is kind of trivial, but the canonical form is actually very informative. The canonical form of a line segment is just the D-log of the two vertices. So you can have a D-log of S down here, and a D-log of T over here, and they come with a minus sign because there's a difference of orientation between the two points. And this looks weird because it looks like you're subtracting two S and T channels. But actually, the minus sign is important because the DT becomes a minus DT. The DT becomes a minus DS on the subspace. And so at the end, you end up adding the two channels and you get the four-point amplitude. So basically, we've established the bi-adjoint amplitude as a canonical form. In practice, this is very useful for computing amplitudes because there are many theorems on computing canonical forms. So here I'll give two methods for computing amplitudes, two novel methods. The first method involves something called the dual associahedron, and the second one involves some triangulating the associahedron. So for the first method, I recall that every convex polytope has a dual polytope. So unfortunately, I won't have a lot of time to really explain how this works. But the important point is that every polytope has a dual polytope. And so in this case, the associahedron also has a dual associahedron. So on the left side, I drew the associahedron for 5 points, which is a pentagon. And on the right, I drew its dual. So dual just, the dual means that its boundaries are inverted from the original polytope. So the edges of the associahedron on the left will correspond to vertices of the dual polytope, and vice versa. And in higher dimensions, codimension D boundaries generally are dual to dimension D minus one boundaries of the dual polytope. And the dual polytope plays an important role in our theory because there's a well-understood fact, which we describe in our paper with Thomas, that the canonical form of a polytope is determined by the volume of the dual polytope. So in case this statement sounds unfamiliar, so one reason you might suspect that it's true is that both the canonical form and the volume are triangulation independent. So for the physics, this implies that the amplitude is the volume of the dual associahedron, which means that we can compute the amplitude by triangulating the dual associahedron.
Sorry, another naive question was, yeah. Does the volume of the associahedron itself compute something?
It will compute the canonical form of the dual. So we don't quite know what that is. It would be the canonical form of the dual associahedron, but which means that it would have its poles would correspond to Feynman graphs. So that would be really strange. I'm not really sure what that would be. Yeah. And if you do this, you find that the Feynman diagram expansion is a particular triangulation of the dual associahedron volume. So for example, so here's the 5-point amplitude, which has 5 terms in the Feynman expansion. And it turns out that this is actually just a triangulation of the dual associahedron with a reference point on the interior. So one reason you might suspect this to be true is that the Feynman expansion is a sum over the vertices of the pentagon, which by duality of polytopes, corresponds to the sum over the edges of the dual of this pentagon, which is also what you do when you do the triangulation. So this picture extends to all n, where a similar kind of triangulation gives you the Feynman expansion. So somehow the path integral or the Feynman diagram approach is just tiling the volume of the dual associahedron. Now, of course, the Feynman expansion is only one of many ways to triangulate a polytope. In fact, it's usually a little bit redundant. So for example, for the dual pentagon, we could have gotten away with a three-piece triangulation. So this would lead to a three-term expansion for the five-point amplitude. And so this provides a new, another expression for the five-point amplitude, which is not obviously the same as the one from before. And this you can extend to all in. And therefore, if you can come up with clever triangulations of the dual sosahedron, you can generate many novel formulas for the amplitude. So this so I went through the last two slides really quickly, and I should probably have spent more time on it. But the key things I want you to remember is that the amplitude is the volume of the dual sosahedron, and the Feynman expansion is the triangulation of the dual. The other method I wanted to say was that, remember that the conical form is also triangulation independent. So that means that you can calculate the amplitude by triangulating the sosahedron directly. So here now, this is the sosahedron, not the dual. So here I'm drawing a three-piece triangulation of the pentagon. And the conical form of that pentagon can be written as the sum over the conical forms of the three triangles. And if you do that, you get another three-term expansion for the amplitudes. And this expansion is very different from what we did before, because now there's spurious poles. And the spurious poles appear because we introduced spurious boundaries in the triangulation. But which they cancel in the sum. And these spurious poles should remind you of spurious poles that appear in BCFW. So what happens in BCFW for planar integrals for super YMLs is that you're adding, is that it's basically tiling some geometry. And then you're adding over the conical form for each boundary. And before closing the section, I just want to make one more comment, which is that, so remember bi-adjoint amplitudes have a pair of orderings for the external particles, usually called alpha and beta. And so far what I discussed applies to the standard ordering, but you could wonder, well, what happens to the other orderings? So the quick answer is that there's some sosahedron for all the orderings. So suppose we consider the case where alpha is 1 to n and b is generic, then the sosahedron in this case is similar to what we had before, except some incompatible boundaries are pushed to infinity. And what I mean by incompatible the boundaries correspond to cubic diagrams. And some of those cubic diagrams are incompatible with the ordering beta. So if you imagine pushing those boundaries to infinity, that gives you the polytope for this ordering. But regardless of this pushing to infinity business, the point I want to make is that the sosahedron is still the geometry that underlies all the bi-adjoint tree amplitudes.
Could you go back for a second to the triangulation of the sosahedron, the previous slide.
Yes.
Could you give a little bit of intuition of why the spurious poles look like that?
Why
are they quadratic?
So in this case, it's because it's linear in the variables, and so these things are actually constants on the subspace. So when you write down the form for a simplex, the factors at the bottom are supposed to be linear in the variables. But these things appear because they are part of the coordinates for the vertices on the subspace. Yeah, but it is kind of unusual that you would get higher order poles. So to quickly summarize what we did, so we started with kinematic space. And we claim that, so there's a big simplex that we cut out using propagators, planar propagators. And then we defined a subspace of the appropriate dimension. And the claim was that the intersection of the subspace with the big simplex gave us the associate Huygens. And we also introduced positive geometries in canonical forms. And we said that the canonical form of the icosahedron is the bijoint amplitude. And then we describe two ways of computing amplitudes geometrically. Now, I promised earlier that the icosahedron knows a lot about physics, like locality and unitarity, and certain soft theorems, which we can derive geometrically. And also, I wanted to discuss scattering equations and color kinematics. So now we're on our way to exploring these properties from a new point of view. I think I will discuss the last two first, and then the other two if we have time. So let's think about scattering equations and how it's related to the icosahedron. Let me begin by reminding you that the moduli space of the open string worldsheet is the space of n order points, mod SL2. And it's well known that this space is also shaped like an icosahedron of the same dimension. Keep in mind, of course, that this is a different icosahedron from the one we constructed. But very soon we will show that these two icosahedra are very closely related. But first, I want to show that I want to just briefly describe why the moduli space is an icosahedron. And I think this is kind of hard to see, at least for me, in sigma variables. So we will describe the boundaries of this space in terms of cross ratios instead. So let's say we define the following cross ratios, which were defined many decades ago. Under string theory related motivations. The exact expression is not really important for us. What's important is that the variables are labeled by a pair of indices, I and j, which you can think of as a diagonal of a polygon with n vertices. So this is analogous to the way in which propagators are labeled. And you can anticipate already that the boundaries of this space are labeled by partial triangulations, as we would expect for the icosahedron. And we observe that the variables satisfy a non-crossing identity, which means that if you have a variable u corresponding to some diagonal ij, then it satisfies this identity where on the right side, we take the product of all the variables whose diagonals cross that diagonal. And this has the feature that if you set uij to 0, then you cannot set to 0 any of the crossing diagonals. And so the moduli space you can think of as the set of all points u between 0 and 1, satisfying the non-crossing identity. And the claim is that this space is again an icosahedron. And this is simply true because the boundaries correspond to all the partial triangulations of the n-gon. So in other words, every boundary is given by setting u to 0 for some collection of non-crossing diagonals, where the crossing diagonals are forbidden, like before, because they violate the identity. So now that we've established the worldsheet associates the icosahedron in moduli space, so we call that the worldsheet icosahedron. We recognize that it's a positive geometry, and therefore it must have a canonical form. And I think I won't go into too much detail, but the canonical form here looks a lot like the canonical form for the isosahedron in kinematic space. And what you find in the end is that if you rewrite the form in sigma space, it's exactly the Parkey-Taylor form. So in other words, the Parkey-Taylor form is the canonical form of the world sheet isosahedron. So I'll come back to this point again if we have time. So basically, the idea is that there are two isosahedra. There's a world sheet isosahedron and there's a kinematic isosahedron which live in different spaces. And the two different spaces are also related by the scattering equations because the scattering equations are the equations between the moduli space and the kinematic space. So it's natural to expect that the two isosahedra are related in some way. And so this is what we find. So the relationship is based on a numerical observation, which is that suppose the kinematic variables are on the interior of the kinematic isosahedron, then if you solve the scattering equations numerically, you'll find that there's always exactly one solution on the interior of the world sheet isosahedron. And so what this is telling us is that the scattering equations act as a diffeomorphism from the world sheet isosahedron to the kinematic isosahedron. One motivation for doing this, one motivation for why this is true, is that you can rewrite the scattering equations in the following way. So this looks a little bit complicated, but it is actually just the rewriting of the scattering equations. And for us, we just need to observe that this can be thought of as a map from the sigmas to the interior of the kinematic isosahedron. So on the left side, we have all the planar propagators. And on the right side, we have all the non-adjacent constants. So all the kinematic variables on the right are constants, are negative constants. And also all the terms involving sigma with two indices are positive because the sigmas are ordered. So this map, so that means that the expression is positive. So that means this gives a map from the ordered sigma space to the interior of the kinematic isosahedron where the propagators are positive. But actually showing that it's a diffeomorphism, So here I'm just saying that so the world sheet is where the sigmas are ordered, and this gives you a map from the world sheet isosahedron to the kinematic isosahedron.
Do you have the structure of that equation in terms of cross relations? Wouldn't that be nicer?
So I was able to work it out at low points, but it was not obvious how to generalize the end.
Isn't that more transparent?
Yeah, it would be more transparent. I think I'm like up to 5 points I was able to work it out. But it was not obvious how to write at a higher point. But yes, it would be good to work that out.
So this is a conjecture at this point. The fact that there is this diffeomorphism.
Yes. Right, so simply proving that it's a diffeomorphism is a little more involved. But let me show you a picture which provides graphical evidence. So the pentagon on the left is the kinematic isosahedron for 5 particles. And here, what I've done is I basically rewrote the scattering equations. So that it looks like a map from sigma 2 and 3 to two of the propagators. So for the moduli space, I gauge fix 3 of the sigma variables in the usual way. So the world sheet isosahedron is just 2 ordered points in this case. And so this map, if you plot this map on, say, Mathematica, you find that it exactly sweeps out the inside of the kinematic isosahedron. So this gives some graphical evidence that the scattering equations is a diffeomorphism between the two isosahedra. Okay, well, that's nice, but so why should we care? So remember at the beginning that I very briefly mentioned that the canonical forms have a push-forward property, which says that if you have a diffeomorphism between two positive geometries, the map pushes the canonical form of one to the other. So we can apply this to our scenario. So the scattering equations map this Wroclawski isosahedron diffeomorphically to the kinematic isosahedron. So the scattering equations must push the canonical form of one to the other. But we already know what these things are. The conical form on the left is the Parquet-Taylor, and the conical form on the right is the amplitude form. So that means that the scattering equations push the Parquet-Taylor form to the amplitude form. And in practice, the way this works is that you start with the Parquet-Taylor form, and then you substitute all the solutions of the scattering equations, and you sum over the solutions. And so if you're familiar with scattering equations, you probably realize by now that this looks a lot like the CHY formula for the bi-adjoint amplitude. So remember that for CHY, you start with a Parquet-Taylor integrand, and then you sum over the solutions, and then you get the amplitude. And this is doing exactly the same thing as the push-forward. So the CHY formula is doing a push-forward through a diffeomorphism, even though that's not what it's usually called. So here we've actually accomplished something unexpected, which is that we basically derived the CHY formula for this theory purely as a geometric consequence. And then there's one small point of confusion that I get asked often, which is that there's two Parquet-Taylor factors here. There's only one up here. And the quick answer to that is that the second Parquet-Taylor factor should be thought of really as a normalizing factor for the delta function. So you're actually only just pushing forward one of the Parquet-Taylor factors. So let me quickly summarize. So there's two isosahedra, and each has its own canonical form. And the scattering equations act as a diffeomorphism from the Wroclawski isosahedron to the kinematic isosahedron. And the CHY formula is the corresponding push forward. This provides another or a different kind of derivation for the CHY formula. And the last point I want to emphasize is that the diffeomorphism property and the push-forward property is a general fact about how positive geometries behave. And it's true independently of its application to scattering equations and isosahedra. And in fact, it has appeared elsewhere in physics. So that's what I wanted to say about scattering equations. And for the last portion of the talk, I want to say a few words about color kinematics. And so one recurring theme in this talk is that amplitudes should be thought of as a differential form on kinematic space. So here we present another rather surprising motivation, which is that forms on kinematic space satisfy Jacobi identities, analogous to the kinematic Jacobi identities for BCJ numerators. And this implies a duality between color and differential forms, analogous to the duality between color and kinematics. And the way this works is the following. So if you think about ordered cubic graphs, so ordered here just means we order the external legs. And for every cubic graph, we assign a form to the graph as the product of all of the d of all of the propagators. So here I've drawn a graph at 5 points, and the corresponding form that we assign to the graph is the product of the d of the two propagators. And then there's an issue about what sign you put in front of that term, and which I'll describe at the end. Just keep in mind that there's a little prescription for the sign that depends on the graph and also on its ordering. And the claim is that these forms quite surprisingly satisfy Jacobi identity. So I should explain the sense in which there's a Jacobi identity. So for any three graphs which are identical except for a four-point subgraph, like in this case, so suppose you have three graphs which correspond to three different channels, S, T, and U, in a four-point subgraph. But otherwise, the external, so there's some sub-amplitudes here in the external legs, which are the same for all of the three graphs. So they only differ in the S, T, and U channels. And surprisingly, we find that any time you have three graphs like this, the forms, the graphs sum to zero as forms. So here the DS, DT, and DU correspond to the three different channels. And then this term is the product of all of the other propagators, except for S, T, and U, which are the same for all of the graphs. And this is the Jacobi identity for the differential forms. And the derivation of the identity is very simple, and it's based on I think I skipped this slide. I think I skipped, might have deleted this slide with the proof, but it's okay. So the claim is that the forms satisfy Jacobi identities, and because they satisfy Jacobi identities, they're dual to color. So that means that anytime you have color factors in an amplitude, that can be converted to a form, and vice versa. So in general, if you have a color-dressed amplitude, so in this case, you can think of your amplitude as a sum over cubic graphs. Here's the propagators for the graph with some kinematic enumerator and the corresponding color factor. So if you convert the color factors to a form, this converts the amplitude to an amplitude form and vice versa. One observation is that the amplitude form contains all the information about the color factor, even though there's no color factor directly involved. And since the forms satisfy Jacobi relations, they behave like BCJ enumerators. So you can basically apply double copy with the forms acting as a set of BCJ enumerators. Now remember that BCJ enumerators have gauge transformations, so it's natural to expect that forms should also have a gauge transformation. So this is the case. So we introduced a GL1 gauge transformation on kinematic space, so this is a little bit unusual, but bear with me. So we rescale every kinematic variable by a GL1 factor. A local GL1 factor. And the rescaling acts non-trivially on the form because the lambda is dependent on S, on the kinematics. So here the transformation acts on the D-log of any kinematic variable by a translation of the D-log of lambda. And this looks a little unusual, but it arises naturally from the duality between color and form. So for example, if you apply the gauge transformation to the amplitude form, we find a curious fact, which is that the form transforms covariantly if and only if the kinematic enumerator satisfy kinematic Jacobi identities. So covariant transformation means that if you apply the gauge transformation, the scattering form transforms by an overall scale. So it behaves, it's basically homogeneous. And we find that the amplitude form transforms covariantly precisely if the kinematic enumerator satisfy kinematic Jacobi identities. So sometimes we also say that the amplitude form is projective of degree d. So d just means, the d doesn't matter, it just means that the form transforms homogeneously for some degree. So for example, we can see this very easily at 4 points. So at 4 points, the amplitude form is a sum over the 3 channels with the usual kinematic numerators, and with the ds, dt, and du corresponding to the color factors for those 3 channels. And if you apply a gauge transformation, a GL1 gauge transformation of st and u, you find that the form behaves covariantly except for this extra term. And so the form is covariant precisely if the kinematic numerator satisfies Jacobi identities. And so in a sense, by requiring a projectivity or gauge covariance, you can actually rediscover the kinematic Jacobi identities. And this holds to higher points as well. So let me summarize the color kinematics. So we argue that forms on kinematic space satisfy Jacobi relations and are therefore dual to color. And every color dress amplitude can be transformed to a form and vice versa. The form contains all the color information, even though there's no colors involved. And then we introduced a local GL1 gauge transformation under which the amplitude is projective when the kinematic numerators satisfy Jacobi identities. Okay, so I think now I will conclude. So there are 3 main ideas that I want to get across. So one is that we introduce positive geometries and canonical forms. And the claim is that for positive geometries that appear in physics, like the associtahedron and amplitudehedron, the canonical form is a physical quantity. So the associtahedron and amplitudehedron, they fall literally under the exact same framework. So sometimes we say that the associtahedron is the amplitudehedron of the bi-adjoint theory, and we anticipate that this paradigm extends to other theories as well. And the second idea I wanted to get across was that forms are dual to the forms on kinematic space are dual to color. And I just want to emphasize that the duality, so unfortunately I didn't explain this, but the duality follows from a 7-term identity for 4-point kinematics. Maybe I'll explain that if somebody asks. And this identity is analogous to the Jacobi identity for structure constants, and it's ultimately the basic building block of this duality. And the third point is that a large class of amplitudes, especially colored amplitudes, should be thought of as forms on kinematic space. Because the form ultimately connects all of our ideas together. So for instance, so on the left side, the form is what you get through the color-form duality. But it's also the form that you get as the canonical form of the kinematic associtahedron. And in the middle, it's also the form that you get by pushing, but from the CHY formalism. And here I also drew the relation for the diffeomorphism, which, as we argued, is what implies this relation in the middle. So for future work, we would like to understand this diagram better for other color theories like Yamil's and nonlinear sigma model. Here I drew the same diagram for Yamil's. So this part of the relation is still true. You can, the YAML's amplitude can be thought of as a form. And you can also get it as a push forward of the Pfaffian form in this case, a moduli space. But its relation to the rest of the isosahedron is, at this point, is still very unclear.
Sorry?
Yeah.
If you already know the isosahedra,
yeah.
Is it a problem that you can't figure out the canonical form?
Well, it's not the canonical form. It's probably some extension of a canonical form.
Oh.
Yeah, because the canonical form is unique. The isosahedron informs the amplitude in the sense that it tells you where the singularities are of the amplitude. So the singularities correspond to the facets of the isosahedron. But that's not enough to constrain the amplitude. So understanding this, the geometric side of this chart would be very good for us. So I think, yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Knows about the locality.
Oh, yeah, so I didn't have time. Well, this part is a little trivial. So locality from the point of view of the amplitude is just a statement that it has physical poles. And canonical forms only have poles on the boundary of the isosahedron. So in other words, the isosahedron should only have physical boundaries. In this case, meaning boundaries corresponding to cutting physical propagators.
But you said string moduli space is like an associatum, right?
Yes.
But string theory is non-local. So
no, it's not a locality in the module. It's a locality for the amplitude. So I'm referring to the associatum in kinematic space. Yeah, so that associatum only has poles corresponding to planar propagators going to zero. And so therefore, the canonical form can only have poles in those regions. The more subtle point is actually how unitarity emerges. So unitarity appears basically because when you go to any boundary of the isosahedron, it splits into a product of a lower isosahedron. So for instance, if you have an eight-point isosahedron and you go on the boundary corresponding to this cut, the isosahedron becomes a product of a four-point and a six-point isosahedron. Just like how if you go to a cut like this on an amplitude, it splits into a four-point amplitude or factors into a four-point amplitude and a six-point amplitude. And so what happens is that the residue of the canonical form becomes a canonical form on the product, which is a product of canonical forms. So that's basically the statement of factorization or unitarity.
So for loop amplitudes, is it clear to you how kinematic variables with a loop momentum would fit into that geometric picture?
So we don't have complete results at loop level. We, if you use the dual variables for planar amplitudes, we did find that a 4.1 loop, the integrand was the form for some polytope. So probably you could make a similar statement for the integrand, the planar integrand at loop level. In the dual variables.
So you need a notion of planarity too.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. How much of the whole story goes through if you have two interacting scalars instead of one?
Yes, so some of it does work. If you have a scenario where every single for instance, you could have two scalars that are interact by some cubic interaction, and so if you have say phi 1 or phi 2, if you have phi 1 squared phi 2, for example, and assuming it's a planar theory, that would also work. The only difference is that you have to put mass shifts on the propagators. So instead of saying the propagator is greater than equal to 0 for the polytope, you say that propagator minus m squared is greater than equal to 0. So that will also cut out an associahedron.
What I don't know about was that suppose you have phi 1 phi 2 squared plus phi 1 cubed plus phi 2 cubed. Depending on which boundary you are, you have a different coupling constant.
So you would have to do a perturbative expansion. So this would only apply at each order.
These all are at the same order, right? You look at tree level diagrams.
Yeah.
You can either have phi 1 into going to phi 2, phi 2, or phi 1 going to phi 1, phi 2.
So those will be different. If they have the same coupling, then I'm not really sure. But if you have different couplings,
one of those couplings is hierarchically smaller than the other.
Yeah, I mean, if those two channels are the same order, then then I'm not really sure.
If there are no other questions, we can talk more detail after. And thanks for the talk.
Thank you.